Dane Rue, author, historian, and a Connecticut native, poses a question he's heard many times, and one that many of us have asked.
This unique name, Wilkes-Barre, go anywhere else in America to find a more unique and just interesting town name. I think it's really fascinating, because what the heck does Wilkes-Barre mean?
Dane Rue was in northeastern Pennsylvania in July, walking through the streets of Wilkes-Barre with Will Cunningham, president of the Luzerne County Historical Society, excitedly taking note of the sites where Colonel John Durkee made his mark. Colonel Durkee, who gave Wilkes-Barre its name. Dane Rue is the author of the recent study, John Durkee, The Forgotten Story of Connecticut's Bold Man from Bean Hill, on that circumnavigation the two men passed the Pennsylvania historical marker at the intersection of South River and South Streets that reads Fort Durkee, first fort built by the Connecticut settlers, begun in April 1769, used during the Pennamite War against Pennsylvania authorities, 1769 through 1771. It stood 1,000 feet from Fort Wyoming. And we might follow Dane Rue's initial question, what does Wilkes-Barre mean, with another one. What does Pennamite mean? What were the Yankee-Pennamite Wars? In digging into the life story of Colonel John Durkee of Norwich, Connecticut, Dane Rue answers those questions. And as we approach the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, he gives us the story of one principled soldier, leader, and family man who was bold in his actions and who contributed to the cause of the colonists in their battle against the crown. After their walk through history in Wilkes-Barre, Will Cunningham brought Dane Rue to the WVIA studio so that he could introduce us to John Durkee in anticipation of Rue's return to the Wyoming Valley on September 18th.
This literally started 10 years ago for me. And it all started when I was about maybe 24, 25 years old or so. I had just joined the board of managers of an organization in my city of Norwich, Connecticut, that operates a local house museum called the Leffingwell House Museum. And as someone who was kind of fresh out of college still a little bit, I wanted to get involved with Revolutionary War history, which is my forte. And so I joined the board on this house museum. This literally started 10 years ago for me. And it all started when I was about maybe 24, 25 years old or so. I had just joined the board of managers of a organization in my city of Norwich, Connecticut, that operates a local house museum called the Leffingwell House Museum. And as someone who was kind of fresh out of college still a little bit, I wanted to get involved with Revolutionary War history, which is my forte. And so I joined the board on this house museum. And I was sort of tasked with coming up with a program idea for the 4th of July, and said, okay, well, I'll get to work on figuring out what that might be. And I had just watched a show on the History Channel called The Sons of Liberty. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, Sons of Liberty, secret organizations, organized activity, clandestine, all sorts of stuff like that. I was really interested in that. So I thought, well, what if there's a Sons of Liberty connection to Norwich, to Norwich, Connecticut? And so after I do some cursory research on the internet, I stumble across this name, John Durkee. And I never heard of this man before, didn't know anything about him. And as I look into him a little bit more, I realize not only does he have an association with the Sons of Liberty, he's actually a leader of the Sons of Liberty in Norwich. And it's not just Norwich, he's actually a leader of the Connecticut Sons of Liberty. And so I really stumbled across that, like, it wasn't expecting it. And it just spiraled. It spiraled from there. And so that was the genesis of my interest.
Well, you tell a fascinating story about the resistance to the Stamp Act, and we're not going to have this tax. What do you think this is? And how Durkee musters folks up, and we're going to go after this Connecticut leader of the office of imposing this tax, and they corner him, and it's a wonderful story.
It is. It's actually quite cinematic in many ways. And that's what really cements John Durkee as the bold man from Bean Hill, which is the subtitle of the book. He, being a leader of the Sons of Liberty, they're very well connected amongst each other in Connecticut, and they're communicating with other Sons of Liberty affiliates throughout the region. And they decide that, you know, they're going to take action against what is known as the Stamp Act, passed in 1765. So it was an egregious act that was passed by the British Parliament, and it was going to be devastating for business and all sorts of activity in Norwich. So they essentially targeted the stamp agents. And in Connecticut, that was a man by the name of Jared Ingersoll. So as the story goes, Ingersoll is so fed up with having to deal with the harassment he's receiving from the Connecticut Sons of Liberty and their supporters that he decides he's gonna take his case before Governor Thomas Fitch and have him deal with it. So he sets off for Hartford from New Haven, Connecticut. He sets off for the capital of Hartford, and he's essentially traveling by himself. And before he even makes it to Hartford, he makes it to the town of Wethersfield, just outside the capital, and he is intercepted by John Durkee and as many as 300 to 500 members of the Connecticut Sons of Liberty. And he's surrounded by these men, many of whom are probably armed and very upset at Mr. Ingersoll. And that must have been a very harrowing experience for him.
And the notion that John Durkee, who has the chutzpah to do this and make the connections, tells you something about him. But why Bean Hill?
Yeah, so Bean Hill is a neighborhood in Norwich, Connecticut. And Norwich is well known for being a city of villages. There are several different little villages and hamlets within Norwich that developed over the course of a couple of centuries now. But Bean Hill is one of those backwater villages about a mile or so from the original settlement of Norwich Town. Norwich was founded in 1659, so about a mile from that original settlement is the Bean Hill Green and the Bean Hill neighborhood. And right around the age of 18 or so is when John Durkee would have come to Norwich and settled in Bean Hill. And so he would have been the notable resident of Bean Hill.
And we don't want to jump over so much, but there was so much going on at the time that he lived. The French and Indian Wars. And first he served the king for a while.
Well, yes, that was his first act as a military man. You know, for the better part of 6 years, he served wearing the uniform of a Connecticut provincial officer in the service of King George II. And so he got a lot of early experience, again, as a military leader. He achieved the rank of major by the end of the French and Indian War. So he is someone who is used to not only working with people, but leading people, but actually commanding soldiers, leading them into battle, leading them into different projects. And so this is nothing new for him. And in fact, so many of his contemporaries talk about that. They talk about his affinity for leadership. They talk about his affinity for being able to inspire folks. So the fact that he was able to lead 300 or 500 men to intercept the stamp agent probably was just another day at the office for him, so to speak.
And we're building to this disgruntled state of, we don't want the tax on tea. We don't want this parliament telling us what it's all building, right?
It is. Yes. Yep. This is all building from about 1765 all the way to the outbreak of war in 1775. And the other thing to bear in mind, too, is that when John Durkee led the Sons of Liberty in Connecticut, this is the summer of 1765. This is only 2 years after the conclusion of the French and Indian War. So he was in service to the king just a couple of years prior to now leading a movement against his mother country. That's a big shift. It's a really big shift for him.
And you think about it. You give us some thoughts, but you don't know that he didn't keep a diary and said, this is why I'm doing this.
Oh, I wish he did. He left behind some letters. He left behind some correspondence, but no real substantial diaries or manuscripts like that. But the pieces that do survive do give you an idea as to who he was as a man and as a leader. But really, when it all boils down to me is, you know, he served in the army as a subject of the king, as a proud Englishman. And now all of a sudden he's seeing actions being taken by the parliament against fellow Englishmen. Because all of us here in the colonies, pretty much most all of us, were very happy being subjects of the king. We were all considered Englishmen. And now we're starting to see a total shift from that. And John Durkee, I know, you know, was really affronted by this because, you know, he wore that uniform. He served his mother country proudly. But now all of a sudden, he and other Sons of Liberty in Connecticut believe that even the king is being undermined by his parliament, by his ministry. So they everyone thought it was a bigger conspiracy to it.
And there are many threads, and we know that he began to serve in the army under General Washington.
Yes, yes.
And we'll get there, but at the same time, we want you to sort out, well, yes, but what is this Susquehanna Company, and why is he bringing people from Connecticut mm-hmm. to the Wyoming Valley?
Yep, it is a little known bit of history, especially in Connecticut, but it's an issue that really stems back to when Connecticut's colonial charter was issued in the 1680s. And the argument being posed by a number of individuals connected to the Susquehanna Company, the whole argument was Connecticut actually has claims to land in what is now eastern Pennsylvania that was granted under our colonial charter issued by King Charles II. And that sparked this entire what we know as the Susquehanna Affair. John Durkee was very close to a number of individuals who were proprietors or shareholders of the Susquehanna Company. This was founded in eastern Connecticut, the town of Windham, where John Durkee's family is from. And so he's very familiar with all of these folks, and then ends up becoming a shareholder himself. So he gets involved with the company, and so much so that he garners a lot of influence with a lot of these folks, particularly with one of the principal shareholders, a man by the name of Eliphalet Dyer, also of Windham, Connecticut. And they were very close friends, the two of them. So John Durkee ends up getting appointed to lead an expedition of men from Connecticut into the Wyoming Valley in early 1769. And that sets off, again, a series of really unfortunate and violent altercations between these Connecticut settlers and residents in Pennsylvania. So that's what kicks off this controversy that we know as the Penemite Wars.
Don't we always get questions about why is it called Forty Fort? What does Forty Fort mean, right?
Yes. So it was the original. It was the band of 40 settlers that came with John Durkee and others out to Pennsylvania, and that was the first 40 to come into the Wyoming Valley area. And John Durkee was responsible for laying out really what is the city center here in Wilkes-Barre. So that's mostly unchanged now. Yeah.
You walked through it today.
We
didn't did. You?
Yes. Yeah. We walked through it. I recognized a couple of different markers, and we found the marker for Fort Durkee, where they built up a fortification right along the bend of the Susquehanna River there. And so that marker is still there, and there's really no vestiges left of the fort or any of those settlements, but we got to walk around where they would have been, and that was just incredible to actually finally be in this same place.
What was the outcome? When it all was said and done, what happened?
For John Durkee, it was disastrous for him. He was public enemy number one, as I like to say, because he and these Connecticut settlers did not receive a welcome from any of the folks here in Pennsylvania, for sure. They were regarded, these Connecticut folks were regarded as interlopers. You know, these men had no right being here. And it resulted in more than one violent altercation So that was a big disaster in that regard. And John Durkee paid the price for it because he was arrested not once but twice. And the second time that he was arrested and brought in by the Pennsylvania authorities, he sat before the magistrate, basically had to defend himself, and he took responsibility for it. He said, listen, I'm the leader of these men, so you're gonna do to me what you're gonna do, but I'm gonna take responsibility for it. And he was jailed. They jailed him for about 2 years in Philadelphia. And it's a miracle that he survived it, because the conditions of that prison were so terrible. It was such squalor to be living in there that it's a miracle he even survived it.
And he returned home.
He did, yes.
And he had a wonderful family.
He did have a wonderful family. It was they were a very patient family because he was away for most of the time. He wasn't home a lot. He came home in between, you know, certain periods, but he really wasn't home for long periods of time. He was either at war, or it was the in-between years where he was involved with Pennsylvania. And then by the time he comes home, and now this is around 1773 to 74 now, we're right on the brink of the American Revolution. So now he's off to fight again. So he's not home for very, very long periods of time. And he has a wife at home, Martha Durkee, and they end up having four children, four young kids. So he doesn't see them a lot. It's very sad.
Before we get into the American Revolution, tell us the story of the native peoples in and around this.
Oh, yes. That's the other side that also is rarely discussed, that the fact that there are indigenous people living here, and they had been living here for generations and thousands of years. For John Durkee's in a bit of a unique position when it comes to indigenous individuals and Native Americans. He ends up working with and commanding a number of Native American soldiers. So he's used to it. He's definitely used to interfacing with folks. In fact, during his time at Fort Durkee, this is a story that I really loved reading about, was Fort Durkee was visited by Iroquois members. And in fact, John Durkee was presented a gift by one of the chiefs or sachems of a wampum belt. And talk about a priceless artifact nowadays. I would love to be able to find that if it still exists. But John Durkee's relations with Native Americans even continued into the American Revolution, where he commanded many soldiers in his units.
When the Revolutionary War started, he was ready to serve his country again.
Yes, he immediately raised units. Connecticut answered the call very quickly after the outbreak of war at Lexington and Concord. They raised as many as about six or so regiments, and then they added a couple more later that summer of 1775. So they were very quick to the response. And John Durkee was among those to raise men to march up to Boston. They encamped at Cambridge during the siege of the city when the British essentially entrenched themselves in Boston. And for several months, they were engaged in the standoff with all of the militia that arrived. And again, this is not an army yet. These are all state militias and local militias that are turning out to try to usurp command here in Boston and dig the British out. This is not even an army yet. George Washington ends up getting appointed commander-in-chief of these forces, but he doesn't arrive until about July or so of 1775 to take command of this army. So really, it's quite a sight, to say the least. And John Durkee is going to be among a few men that do have prior military experience. So he has a lot of colleagues and a lot of friends who also fought in the French and Indian War. But there are other folks, too, that have not fought in an armed conflict yet. So he's then going to have to take command of a big variety of people with differing skill sets.
And did he become close to George Washington?
He knew Washington, and Washington knew John Durkee. Washington had very close relationships with his top commanders. He knew them all well. John Durkee, being a colonel, he is not in the same echelon as, say, a brigadier general or a major general, so he doesn't have quite as close of a relationship with Washington, but they do know each other, and they do communicate directly. There's a couple of letters that still survive between each of them. John Durkee held Washington in very high regard pretty much everybody did. And so Washington had quite that effect on those. And John Durkee was one of them. John Durkee was also a lot older than George Washington. That's something that kind of goes unnoticed as well, is that, you know, John Durkee's the old man in the group. He's born in 1728. And so he's a little bit older than Washington is. And by the time his military career ends in the Revolution, he's among the most senior colonels in the Continental Army.
What about John Durkee's interaction with Benedict Arnold?
Oh, that's a great question. I have only ever been able to find one instance of an exchange of letters between John Durkee and Benedict Arnold. And the most interesting part about that exchange was that it took place barely a month or so before Arnold's treason was uncovered. So this is getting into like late August, early September of 1780. Arnold is in command of West Point, and he is neck deep into a conspiracy to join the British by surrendering the plans of West Point to his conspirator, Major John Andre. And they're just weeks away from this conspiracy unfolding when he exchanged a letter with John Durkee. It's the most innocuous letter. They don't discuss anything interesting. It's really just all very straightforward business, and that's it. There's no, I wish there was something else interesting, but nothing.
And John Durkee was at Valley Forge.
Yes. Yes. Yep. John Durkee was at all of the major engagements, all the major early campaigns of the war. He crossed the Delaware with George Washington. And he also had his son with him, John Jr. That's another thing that that I thought was really amazing, too, is that John Durkee loved his family, and he wanted often to see his family, even though he was away at war. So he writes to his wife, Martha, and on more than one occasion, he's like, I really would like to see the kids, with your permission. He always wanted to defer to his wife for giving the final say. But once his two oldest sons, John Jr. and his other son Phineas, when they were old enough, they joined the army as a fifer and a drummer. so he had his two oldest sons with him throughout the early campaign, and John Jr. and his father John Durkee, they crossed the Delaware together.
And so in that famous painting, in one of those boats,
he's somewhere, yeah,
in there with John Jr.
Yeah, because yes, he would be among those boats, yeah.
Well, we'll circle back to images and mm-hmm. portraits and paintings. You had to look and say, well, what does John Durkee look like? Are mm-hmm. there images of him? Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So there were never any portraits done of John Durkee when he was living, at least none that we know about. The only unofficial image that has existed was published in 1909 in Volume 2 of History of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And that portrait is in the beginning of the book. It's a portrait that was used as the basis to form the cover art of my book. But there's no official attribution to the artist, so we don't know who designed the original, but that's the way the artist decided to depict John Durkee. So we really don't know if he looked like that. We have no way of knowing what he looked like. But years and years later, when I was working with my friends Rob and Susan Durkee, Susan was the portrait artist behind the cover art of the book, she based that portrait she did off of the one from the History of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Did Colonel Durkee have any other contact that you're aware of with northeastern Pennsylvania after going off to fight in the Revolutionary War?
He did. He definitely maintained contacts with folks. He was very close with Zebulon Butler, who was also readily entrenched in Pennsylvania. So he maintained communication with Butler. He maintained a lot of communication with folks in Pennsylvania. But he was never directly involved anymore. Again, he earned his reputation as public enemy number one, so he kept out of the official business.
And he was injured, and you indicate to us that that was a turning point for him in his life.
It was, yep. This was a big turning point for him. And what I've gathered throughout my research is that it was pretty clear that his health was suffering, particularly after he was released from jail. And this is now around 1772 into 1773. His health doesn't really seem to recover from that point forward. And so he's struggling a lot with his health and his stamina. But it really starts to spiral downward after the Battle of Monmouth in 1778. probably early on in the engagement. He is leading the vanguard of troops at Monmouth. So they are in the thick of the action. And he is shot through his right hand. A musket ball totally shatters his right hand. He may have even sustained some injuries to his left hand, which was reported by his friend and colleague, Jedediah Huntington. So he might have even had some injuries on his left hand, too. But he pretty much loses all operable abilities with his right hand after that injury. And he'll never take another field command after that injury, unfortunately.
What impact did he have in this place where we are?
His impact may not be seen visibly, but if you look close enough, you can see it. Because as soon as I reached the city center, I went, that's it. I could see the map in my memory. I could see that's the city center. I could see the diamond formation. I could see the road structure that he laid out. And so it was visible to me because I've been researching this for a little while now. So for me, that was pretty obvious. And so many folks will pass through and they might not realize it. But the other thing too is this unique name, Wilkes-Barre, like, go anywhere else in America to find a more unique and just interesting town name. I think it's really fascinating because what the heck does Wilkes-Barre mean? Sir John Wilkes and Sir Isaac Barre, two members of parliament that supported the colonial Americans in that era of no taxation without representation. We actually had two representatives in parliament advocating for us, and it was Sir John Wilkes and Sir Isaac Barre. John Durkee admired them so much. He served with them in the French and Indian War. So he knew these guys, and they probably knew him. And John Durkee was unabashed in his loyalties and in his allegiances. So that's him. When it comes to the naming of the town of Wilkes-Barre, it originated with John Durkee. He named this town, and that is evident in all of the earliest correspondence back from 1769 that you can find on this town. So that's all John Durkee, and we have him to thank for it. So I just think that's really cool.
You have come about as close to knowing as much as anybody does about him, about the person, John Durkee, Colonel John Durkee. And you say, like anybody, he's a human being, but he's a hero. Tell us what you've sorted out.
Yes. Well, this is a man who, again, earned this nickname, the Bold Man from Bean Hill. And rarely do you earn a nickname that goes down in history. That only certain people get to have that distinction. And so for me, that was just motivation for me to really find out why this man became what he became and why did people view him like this. And this has been a process literally over the past 10 years. I have been researching and writing and looking into what this man has accomplished. But really for me, what makes him so unique and extraordinary is that he's a regular man. He's not in the same class as the Washingtons, the Jeffersons, the Hamiltons. He's John Durkee from Norwich, Connecticut, and his story is very much like the thousands and millions of other stories of which can be claimed by other Americans. But we don't know those stories. We obviously know the story of Washington and Hamilton and Jefferson, but not John Durkee. And there are millions more like him that'll never have books written on them. They'll never have books written on their lives. And for me, I wanted to, again, write this book that was never written and draw some attention to, again, a really regular person who held almost a senior level commission in the Continental Army and really get to understand what life was like in the American Revolution from his perspective. The perspective of him and his family and those like him, because those are the people that were fighting on the front lines. Those were the people that were, again, making the real difference and made this country what it is.
Dane Rue, historian and author of the recent volume titled John Durkee, The Forgotten Story of Connecticut's Bold Man from Bean Hill, just released by Keys to History. The Luzerne County Historical Society will present its President's Dinner on September 18th. The Luzerne County Historical Society Board President, William Cunningham, brought Dane Rue to the WVIA studio at the end of July in anticipation of this event that will be Thursday, September 18th at 6 in the evening in the Grand Hall at the Westmoreland Club, 59 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre. The evening's events will feature a keynote presentation by Dane Rue on his acclaimed new book, John Durkee, The Forgotten Story of Connecticut's Bold Man from Bean Hill. And Mr. Rue has a complete uniform that would have been appropriate and exact for John Durkee, and he will deliver his presentation in that uniform. In addition to the evening's presentation by Dane Rue, guests will have a rare opportunity to view a selection of original artifacts from the Battle of Wyoming and the American Revolution era drawn from the Luzerne County Historical Society's collection. For more information on the web, luzernehistory.org, luzernehistory.org. That's the Luzerne County Historical Society's President's Dinner, Thursday, September 18th at 6 in the evening in the Grand Hall at the Westmoreland Club, 59 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre, with a keynote presentation by Dane Rue, author and historian, speaking about his acclaimed new book, John Durkee, The Forgotten Story of Connecticut's Bold Man from Bean Hill. And in addition to the presentation, you'll have an opportunity to view a selection of original artifacts from the Battle of Wyoming and the American Revolution era, and that's all drawn from the Luzerne County Historical Society's own collection. For more information on the web, luzernehistory.org, luzernehistory.org. And Dane Rue's book is published by Keys to History. It's a Keys to History publication. And for more information, keystohistory.com, keystohistory.com. Dane Rue is spelled D-A-Y-N-E. Rue, R-U-G-H, D-A-Y-N-E, R-U-G-H.